On this edition of On Your Money, we will talk about the growing popularity of a new kind of fantasy football and offer advice to those thinking about participating. I'm Joy Curdine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Also on this edition of On Your Money, what to do with leftover Halloween candy besides eat it, and Social Security benefits and Medicare premiums, plus, as always, answers to your personal finance questions. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Let me welcome our guest. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
So what is this? There's a new type of fantasy football that's becoming really popular, and it's attracting a lot of attention, too. It's gaining the attention of politicians and regulators. What's this all about, Kevin?
Well, chances are you, Joy, or someone you know is a participant in some form of fantasy sport. Fantasy Sport Trade Association says about one of in six Americans play some kinds of fantasy sport. And how this works is you basically choose from professional players in a sport, usually, and then you assemble your own roster, and then you would compete against other people. And it started, the first one probably started in 1978. It was a group of sports writers. And they called it the Rotisserie League because that was the bar that they met in to draft the players, and they'd meet up to compare notes and pay off. And then football took over, and that became wildly popular. You'd get together with a group of friends, draft at the beginning of the season, and then go head-to-head during the season. Then whoever had the most wins would get some form of small payoff in cash. And then there's been a new version, though, that's come out where people can compete each week against strangers online, and not just football, but lots of other sports as well.
And how popular is this new version?
It's wildly popular. It's exploded this year. The two big companies that run this are called DraftKings and FanDuel. And they say that in the first few weeks of October, they were getting up to 9 million entries per week. And it's mostly football, but it's also Major League Baseball, the NBA, NASCAR, even professional golf and mixed martial arts as well. These two companies now are each worth about $1 billion thanks to investments not only from private venture capitalists, but also many of the networks have invested in these, like NBC and Fox, and also several of the leagues themselves have invested in this, like Major League Baseball, etc. And those companies used a lot of the investment money and their revenue to become the biggest television advertisers in America in September, spending almost $300 million so far this year.
People really play fantasy mixed martial arts?
I know. I guess it works. You pick your guy or your woman in Ronda Rousey's case, and you just hope for the best, I guess.
So what kinds of problems have resulted?
There have been a few small ones and one big one. The small ones have included allegations of insider trading. One DraftKings employee won $350,000 in 1 week trading on the other FanDuel site and using information that was not publicly available about a player's status, whether or not he was going to play or not. That is now being investigated by the FBI. There's also a lawsuit by some NFL players that these companies are using their likenesses without permission and making money off of them. But the big one, of course, is this gambling? And according to an interpretation of the Unlawful Internet Gambling Act of 2006, you would think something named that would actually ban this, but it says no, it's not gambling. It's a game of skill, and therefore it is legal. But several states already have banned this. In five states, it's banned, and others are considering banning it as well. And it even came up as a subject during the recent GOP debate that whether or not it was going to be regulated, should it be regulated, or not. Of course, as the New York Times pointed out afterwards, there was no discussion in that debate of whether or not, you know, Wall Street or anybody else, drug manufacturers, should have more regulations, but we were going to focus on fantasy sports.
Well, so what advice do you have for those who might want to be participating in these fantasy sports games?
Well, to take the high road, it's like any other pursuit where you spend money on it. Hopefully you get some entertainment, some enjoyment out of it, and maybe even make a little bit of money off it. Keep in mind, it even says at the bottoms of many of these ubiquitous television ads that the average bet is about $6 and the average winning is about $22. That sounds good, except about 70% of players actually lose money in a given week. And this has quickly become not only the arena of the kind of people who played online poker a few years ago when that was supposedly legal, but it's also having the same kind of effect where there are a few people who devote hours and hours a day to playing this, and they have computer algorithms that enter hundreds and hundreds of different teams or players in a given day, and then they assemble their statistics to hopefully give them a better edge. And it's these big whales who are making money out of the small fish. But if you limit your spending to a certain amount of dollars per month, say I'm only going to spend $25 per month or something, and when that's gone, then I'm done until the next month. And watch your time spent on this as well, away from your friends and family. They might notice it if you're devoting hours and hours to this. And more importantly, check with your employer, because if you're doing this online during work, it may be forbidden by your employer's policies, and for good reason. Challenger and Gray did a study a few years ago where they figured out that each year $16 billion of productivity was lost due to people playing fantasy sports during the work week, and that was before the explosion of these daily fantasy online sites.
Yeah, really. You know, and here's another tip, and this might not be the new version, but keep it to yourself if you're watching the Packer game with me and your other players, you know, that you're rooting against the Packers, so your team will do better on fantasy football. That's not good either.
It's amazing the way fantasy sports can completely destroy lifelong blood affiliations of Packers fans who all of a sudden are you know, rooting for Jay Cutler to throw a touchdown against the Packers just because it will help them and win $3 in their fantasy league.
You can't do that. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire in Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. You should consult with your financial advisor prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you have a personal finance question that you would like to ask Kevin, you can call us right now. We have an open line for you at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Well, we have been getting several questions regarding a possible increase in Medicare premiums. Can you shed some light on this, Kevin?
Yeah, and it's the increase is usually standard. Just Medicare premiums generally have no direction to go other than up. But this is due to a strange quirk in the laws regarding Medicare and Social Security. Many people have Medicare payments taken from their Social Security checks, and Medicare premiums are going to go up next year, and Social Security is not going to be increased next year. When that happens, there's something called the Hold Harmless Law, which says that if Social Security doesn't increase, and it won't, most recipients who are receiving Social Security will not also be subject to the increase in Medicare premiums. But, of course, they need an increase because the program is running short. And so those people who are Medicare beneficiaries are left to be shouldering the entire burden of the premium increase.
So who bears the brunt of this, and how much might our Medicare premiums go up?
It'll be about 30% of Medicare recipients. It'll generally be those who don't have the premiums deducted directly from their check. It will be those who are receiving Medicare but not Social Security, meaning they're over 65, but they haven't applied for Social Security yet. It will be new enrollees, and then those in very high incomes who have other income outside of Social Security. It might be pension, it might be dividend interest, etc. And they could see an increase of over 50% on their monthly premiums, which means they could jump from anywhere to $159 per month up to $500 per month, again, for those who are in the very high income brackets.
Are there any ways to avoid this?
Well, it might be only temporary, but it might kick in again if we get back to a low inflation era again. And this has happened in 2010 and 2011 again. If you are thinking about this and it's an issue, you might want to take Social Security sooner and then get the Medicare payments deducted. Congress still may fix this. They may spread this out. They may kick the can down the road a little bit so it doesn't affect you. And don't let this little bump in your Medicare premiums be the determining factor in whether or not you should take Social Security. You may want to take it, but don't do it just because you're finding that you're one of the people whose premiums are bumping up.
Well, coming up as On Your Money continues, we will talk a little bit more about a Social Security benefit claiming strategy. So stay with us for that. And if you have a question for Kevin, you can join us right now at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Let's go to John in Fond du Lac. Hi, John.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I love, this is probably my favorite show on WPR, so I'm glad that I get a call in sometimes.
But thanks,
so
John.
Thank you both very much. My question is that it's with the fantasy football and stuff, and I know you addressed that it's kind of gambling, but it's kind of not because of the loophole. And is it investment? Is this something that we can invest in? Or is it, like, what's the difference between that and video poker and the slot machines, I guess?
Well, are you talking about it, how it fits into your overall income stream, or are you talking about deducting your losses?
Yeah, I guess I'm not sure how... Is this an investment? I mean, we kind of are talking about it like it's not gambling, but I guess
I would look on it in from a, I don't know if the regulators will say this. My guess is that they will, because then it means that they can regulate it and tax it to a greater extent. And also the good people in Las Vegas and Atlantic City will probably have something to say about it as well. But I would say look upon it, hopefully not as gambling, but as a pastime, again, to try to put a positive spin on it. But people have lost a lot of money doing it, and it can, again, it can occupy a lot of your time. But it's, in my mind, it's no different than just driving to the casino and spending a day there. Hopefully you make a little money, and hopefully you don't lose any more than you can afford to lose.
Right. You are not, as a financial planner, advising people to play fantasy football to pay for their retirements.
Well, if they're not very good at it, then I'd like them to play and then hopefully play against me. But no, I don't think this is something you should use to augment your income of any kind. Yeah.
John, thank you very much for the call. We will get to more of your questions for Kevin McKinley, financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, in just one moment. 1-800-642-1234 is our number if you have a question. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley, who has information and advice on your money. If you have a question, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. David in San Francisco is with us. Hello, David.
Hey, morning, Joy. Morning. And let's see, is it John?
No, it's Kevin.
That's close enough.
Yeah, sorry about that. You know, I'm out in San Francisco, and we discovered many years ago that the banks were charging service fees to manage the poor's electronic funds transfers. So, in other words, they don't hand out checks anymore to the poor. They give them an electronic, like a little credit card, a debit card, and it turns out that the banks are making out millions. They're making millions of dollars per year to run these things. So it's like a welfare program for the banks to handle the welfare system. And so I'm wondering, in the old days, the state, by handing out cash, found that cash would then get spread around the neighborhood. But when it gets locked into a card all of the time, the bank gets to use it in service, and then they can sell identity, they can sell shopping patterns, they make money so many different ways with those electronic cards.
David, what would you like Kevin to say about this?
Well, I'm just wondering if the state is aware of this, and in their pretense of being some new electronic way of tracking the poor, is the state making money by doing this, or is it just a kind of a new form of graft?
It's kind of a loaded question.
Yeah, I
don't know if it's a form of graft. It's a form of the banks are getting paid to do something. And one of the big issues facing not only the financial services industry, but also governments who do want to help people by giving them money to live their lives, is how do you help them In an electronic banking society where there really isn't, it's a relatively cashless society, and they do get fees on those. Where the fees, I think, are more insidious are when people sell these prepaid cards to people who are unbanked. And Susie Orman and Russell Simmons and Kim Kardashian, I think, even have had some celebrity-endorsed prepaid cards that turned out to be loaded with fees. They would charge them fees every single month. They would charge them fees if they did use it. They would charge them fees if they didn't use it. They would charge them fees if they called in for the questions about the balance. And I get that. I get that these are services that may be provided and need to be paid for, but not just to use it electronically. It's like an ATM fee. And so, yeah, you do definitely have to watch out for those. And it is one more way that people who don't have a lot of money can still, even when they get some of it, it still goes very, very quickly.
Thank you very much, David. Sharon emails, can you buy a Roth with your 529?
Can you buy a Roth with your 529? I suppose technically you could take money out of a 529. You would be taxed and penalized on the earnings portion of your withdrawal. And then you could use that to make a contribution to a Roth IRA. She might be confusing a statement we have made here a few weeks ago and several other times before that, is where you can use a Roth IRA as kind of a college savings account, meaning that you can save money in a Roth IRA and then if you need the money to pay for your higher education expenses or anybody else's, or quite frankly, any other kind of expense, you can pull the contributions back out of the Roth IRA, just the money you've put in, and pay no taxes or no penalties whatsoever at any time and for any purpose. So that might be what she's thinking of. We talked before, someone had said about setting up money for kids' accounts a few weeks ago, and we had talked about saying that you could actually set up a Roth IRA for a kid who has earned income, make the contributions for the kid, and then if it is needed for college, you can pull the contributions back out with no taxes or penalties.
I'm Joy Cardine talking with Kevin McKinley. Kevin is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, with us just about every week at this time with information and advice on your money. If you have a personal finance question for Kevin, we have an open line for you at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post a question on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet it at Joy Cardine Show. Lisa in Whitefish Bay is with us now. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about car insurance. I'm going to be giving my daughter, who just finished grad school and is starting work as a guidance counselor, my old car that's a 2008 with 90,000 miles on it. And she started shopping around for car insurance, and she's getting what seems to me to be pretty high quotes. And I told her to get more information, of course, about the limits and the deductible and everything. But I'm wondering what would be some general guidelines for her in her position now just starting out for what her car insurance should be covering?
Well, I think it's an older car?
Yes, it's a 2008 Subaru, and it has 90,000 miles.
Okay, that's actually in the lexicon. That's a newer car.
Yeah.
The median age of cars on the road right now is about 11 years, meaning half are older than 11 years and half are newer than 11 years.
Oh,
and,
okay.
And so that's a very, it's an even more benevolent gift than what you thought, at least. I would tell her on a car like that I would give up the collision coverage on it, but you might want to look at doing that. But again, for someone who is maybe cost conscious, giving up coverage on insurance to save a little money in premium can end up costing them a lot more money if and when they do get in some kind of crash or need to get the premiums, because they don't have a lot of savings set aside to cover things that would otherwise be covered for. So the collision might be a way to give up. I would also try to get the deductible set up as high as possible, again assuming she has enough money set aside to pay that deductible if and when she does get in some form of a collision. And she also, if she has other insurance, like if she's a homeowner or a renter or she has health insurance or whatever, if she deals with a company that provides all of those kinds of policies and she needs them, by purchasing them all in the same place, sometimes she'll get a significant discount on the overall cost of the policies. In some cases I've seen the car insurance has basically been free because they combined all the other policies that they were getting and they found that they saved more money that way, enough to pay the actual cost of the car insurance premiums.
Oh, okay.
Well, I'll let her know that. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa, for the call. Good luck to you and your daughter. Kim emails, recently my husband and I were fortunate enough to inherit land valued around $250,000. We are in our early 30s and with one child and a new mortgage of $200,000. We do not want to keep the land and are planning to sell it soon. When we do, what should we do with the money? We have college loan debt, but only around $7,000. Should we pay off our mortgage and all of our bills, save some of it, or invest it? What do you think, Kevin?
Well, congratulations. And depending on the cost basis of the land and what kind of tax situation they might be in on that, let's just assume that they're going to get the entire $250,000. I would like to see them, first of all, set aside enough for 12 months' worth of living expenses. And that's two things. One thing, it prevents them from blowing it all right away and exhausting it. And also, it forces them to add up their monthly living expenses, which is a very key component to becoming financially independent, to know what you spend and to cut whatever you feel like you can cut. And the 12 months will help bridge any big financial gap that they come across in the future. Then after that, I would have them max out any pre-tax at-work retirement savings plans, and they'll see a drop in their paycheck, of course, because that money is going into a pre-tax retirement plan, but they should use the savings then to supplement that. And if they want to do a good kind of mental compartmentalization, they could just have if they're going to bump up their monthly contribution, say, by $500, then have $500 sent from an account directly to the checking account that they normally use to pay their bills. And then finally, I would encourage them to pay off the college loan debt. $7,000 isn't too significant. It's not going to hurt them too bad. But usually the interest rate is higher than what they can get on that money. And usually, after setting aside 12 months of living expenses and then maxing out their pre-tax retirement plan contributions, within about 3 or 4 years, that $250,000 will probably be used up. But the good news is most of it won't be gone. It will just be in different places that are more advantageous to their situation.
Thanks very much, Kim, for the email. You can email your question to onyourmoney@wpr.org, or you can call 1-800-642-1234 if you have a personal finance question for Kevin. And a reminder, a friendly reminder, that false praise is always welcome. It is time now for Smart Assets. A recent measure from Congress could eliminate a Social Security claiming strategy. Oh, no, Kevin, what's going on?
Well, it's called the file and suspend strategy. We've discussed it in the past, and I'm sure we're going to be discussing it again plenty in the next few weeks. This is available to married couples. And generally the way it works is the higher earner files for Social Security, and forgive my use of gender here, but let's just say it's her money at full retirement age, but then suspends it, meaning she does not get her payment. And then the lower paid spouse over their lifetime would be eligible for spousal benefits. So he could file for his spousal benefit. And then that's usually at 66. And then at 70, the higher earner would claim her final payments at age 70, and then maybe the spouse would claim too, if it's possible, if that benefit exceeds what her spousal benefit would be.
All right, so this may be going away.
Yeah, a recent agreement between Congress and the president said that they're going to close this loophole. If you've already filed and suspended, you can still continue with your payments. They were talking originally about actually canceling out the payments, meaning a bunch of people would have lost their checks, but I think that's gone off the table for the time being. Or if you are turning 66 within the next 6 months or so, you still may be able to file and suspend. So if you've turned 66 between May of 2016, be able to do it. Everybody else will be done with it, and in the future, you will have to file and actually collect your benefits to get benefits for others. And then also, there's another one that might be of issue to some people. That is where you can't file restricted spousal benefits, and this would typically apply to divorced or widowed recipients. They could often file for spousal benefits on their ex-spouse or their deceased spouse, if you will, and get a check for the time being, and then file for their own benefits. Now, under this new rule, you will only be able to get the higher of the two benefits, yours or the restricted one, whichever serves you better, but you can't get one and then get the other later on.
All right. Yeah, boy, we get a lot of questions on this. What are some other courses of action that people could consider?
Well, you might want to reevaluate your retirement plans. It may still make sense to wait, especially if you'll get a higher benefit. It goes up about 8% per year for every year that you do wait to receive it. And unless you fit in that window, this isn't going to be an issue for you. And if you do fit in the window and you can afford to file and suspend, meaning you're only going to get a smaller amount of Social Security than what you would otherwise be able to take at this moment, you might still want to consider going ahead and doing it sooner rather than later.
So when is it best to take Social Security sooner rather than later?
Generally, it's best to wait to full retirement age. Again, 66 for most people. That's usually the best single philosophy to do, is just wait till 66 before doing any kind of claiming for it. If you delay taking it, whether you're 62 or 69, any kind of delaying strategy, you almost always have to live at least until 80 to make delaying make sense, because as I mentioned, you may get an 8% higher check if you wait a year, but you will have missed out on a year's worth of checks that it takes usually that long to make it up again, to make up the foregone payments. If you can afford to live off of your interest and other income, it also may make sense to wait. But if you have to tap savings and investments just to survive, meaning draw down your principal, it's probably better at that point to take it sooner rather than later.
1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley, and our next caller is Tom in New Franken. Hi, Tom.
Hello there. I have a question, and that is I'm 70 and a half, and I'm wondering if I can start a Roth IRA. I am not working. Just wondered if I can start a Roth IRA.
You can open a Roth IRA and you can convert your current IRA money to a Roth IRA if you want and pay taxes on the income, or I should say it can be taxed as income, but you cannot contribute to it unless you or your spouse has earned income.
Okay. What about if she's got a small, my wife has a small job and pays her like $3,000-$4,000 a year. Is that the limit that I could contribute to a Roth IRA?
Yeah, if she's contributing to it, it's probably best if she makes the contribution for it based on her earnings. And that's the max that the two of you can do. You could only, in for couples, even one who's not working, they can't open up a spousal IRA or Roth IRA if they qualify for it. But you can only, if she makes $4,000, the total that can be contributed to either her accounts or your accounts is her earnings, $3,000 or $4,000.
All right. Thanks, Tom, for the call. Good luck. Cal in New Holstein is with us. Hi, Cal.
Hi. I have a question on my pension. I'm eligible to collect my full pension at 65, and I also have the option of waiting until I'm 70. My wife works full-time as a nurse right now, and I'm not sure either on how much I should claim myself on that as a deduction or not claim anyone, and if it makes more sense to wait until I'm 70 to collect that pension, or am I losing the money that I could be getting right away at 65.
I would prefer, Cal, that most people take pensions. Is it a state pension, or is it a public pension, or private?
Private pension.
Yeah, I'd prefer that you take it sooner rather than later, like Social Security in most cases. The reason being is that many pension funds are struggling right now because they are earning less money than what they planned on, especially if they've invested it fairly conservatively. And their recipients are generally living longer than what they planned on. And the pensions are struggling to remain fully funded. And therefore, several pensions have already said to people, you know what, I know we promised you $1,000 a month for the rest of your life or whatever the original agreement was, but we're not going to be able to honor that obligation. So instead, here's a lump sum of, say, $110,000 or something, which is nice, except people quickly realize, they say, hey, wait a minute, this is only 6 or 7 years worth of monthly payments I was going to get. And I would much rather have you get that money in your hand now rather than leave it up to the pension fund to hopefully manage it well when they have lots of other competing interests, you know, the people funding the pension and the people managing the pension. And they're not going to look out just for you, whereas when you get that money in your hand, you get to do with it whatever you want. So I'd rather have you take the money today rather than wait until 70.
Thank you, Cal. Adam in Reedsburg is with us now. Hi, Adam.
Hi, good morning.
I had a 401k through my employer. I took a loan out against earlier this year, and I've since left the job. And I'm wondering if there's any way that I can pay that back now to avoid some of the penalties and fees, or if I'm just stuck with those.
Right. If what happens for people who leave their place of employment, typically if they have a loan on their 401k, they have to pay it back right away. And if not, whatever they've borrowed becomes a taxable distribution to it. And if you have the money, definitely pay it back. Is there any other source you can, like, do you have a home equity loan or a...
Well, we're selling some property, and after that property sale, which would be before the end of the year, we'd be able to pay back what I owe. But it's after the loan period is expired, so...
Mm. Okay. What I would do is I would contact the plan administrator first and see what their rules are when you have to get the money back into it. Again, usually it's going to be within, for sure, the year end, sometimes 60 days after your employment terminates. And then I would also go to your bank or your credit union, explain the situation, and hopefully you can get some kind of personal loan from them that you can use to pay that back, and then you can pay the personal loan off once you get the sale of the property to come through as well, too. But, you know, it's not the end of the world. You were going to pay taxes on this money sooner or later than anyway. You were probably not going to pay penalties on it if you didn't take it out before 59 and a half. So it's not the end of the world to have to repay this loan, but I'd sure hope that you can come up with the cash to offset whatever you can. And even paying part of it back will avoid part of the taxes and penalties.
Good luck to you, Adam. Thank you for the call. We'll get to more of your calls, your questions, your personal finance questions for Kevin McKinley at 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. When On Your Money continues, we'll talk about what we can do with that leftover Halloween candy. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
My mama told me you better shop around.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley, here to answer your personal finance questions and to talk about personal finance issues that affect all of us. Most of us either have lots of candy left over from Halloween or have kids who have collected more than they can safely eat. there are some good ways, though, to put all that sugar to good use. So, how so, Kevin?
Joy, do you have candy left over?
I don't want to be a spoiler here, but I took my candy somewhere yesterday before I even knew that you were going to recommend this today.
Well, good for you. Mm-hmm. About 71% of American households handed out candy this year, and they spent about $2.1 billion on that candy, according to the good people at the National Retail Federation. So we wanted to give you some hints if you were in this category of having too much of what you should do with it, which is better than just throwing it away or just sitting in front of the TV with your glass of Pinot Grigio, watching Lifeline, Lifetime movie for women, home alone, eating Halloween candy, drinking Pinot Grigio. Not saying that was you, Joy. I'm just speaking in general terms.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with it. One of my favorite ways to spend a Saturday.
Yeah, in fact, I've been seeing some wine pairings and Halloween candy charts.
And if you drink enough wine, it really doesn't matter what candy you're eating.
But I will say that I also thought about bringing it to work, but then I thought, I'm going to eat it there, too. So,
exactly. And you love your coworkers too much to hurt their health.
That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. So what are some things that are better than just throwing it away?
Well, here's a novel idea that you can use to help teach kids the benefits of delayed gratification. And this is where you get a big calendar, like a wall calendar that has the dates, you know, in big blocks. And then you have the kid choose from his or her candy and tape a piece of that candy to each day on the calendar so that they can decide which ones they're going to eat now, which ones they're going to eat later. And then you will know that that's their candy, piece of candy for the day. So you can have one piece of candy per day. And it gets them kind of excited about planning out the candy of when they're going to have what. They might choose to eat their favorite stuff right away or save that for last. And it's also a good way to track their eating to make sure that, you know, I've had this happen as a parent where about November 4th, after the kids promising that they're only going, they want to take the candy in the room, they're only going to eat, you know, one piece a day, that you find, you know, half pound of wrappers in their garbage can with no explanation as to why those are there.
I'm trying to think what I would eat first and what I would save until last. I think I'd eat the Kit Kats first.
Yeah, you got it, because you might die. Yeah. You, and then you'd say, well, this is sad. I didn't even get to eat those Kit Kats. I was stuck eating Laffy Taffy on my last day.
What are they called? The Smarties. Those are the worst, I think.
No. Smarties are not the worst. It's those peanut buttery things in the brown and orange, or black and orange.
Things.
Yes, and not even chewy. You can pull out fillings with that. No, those are the worst.
All right, so if you don't want your kids to eat all of that candy, what else?
Well, what did you do with it when you...
I went to a local dentist who was participating in a Operation Gratitude project where this candy was going to be sent to the troops.
Yep, and if you want to look for a dentist who may be running a program like this, go to HalloweenCandyBuyback.com and you can search in specific geographic areas. And then the money is sent to troops, or you can do it yourself by going to, as you mentioned, Joy, OperationGratitude.com. And it could be a neat project for kids to not only bundle up some candy, but send a nice letter, draw some pictures for it, and then they also recommend you include other dental products to help scrub away that sugar, bath products, toiletries, whatever. It can be a fun thing for a kid to do to help think about someone else rather than just how much candy they've managed to accumulate.
Yeah, and this was, they will pay you, I don't know, some amount per pound if you bring it to one of these dentists, but you can also donate it, and that's what I did. I wasn't going to ask for any cash for that. So that felt like a good way to
yeah,
use
I think
that.
So.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, to avoid the leftover Halloween candy dilemma next year?
Well, if you are very high-minded, remember when we were kids, they had those little cardboard UNICEF boxes that you could go around and collect change or whatever? Well, they still have those at unicefusa.org/trick-or-treat. They still have the program going where you can raise money instead of just getting candy for it for UNICEF. But if you're going to be handing out candy, go for quality over quantity. The three most popular types of candy, according to the National Confectioners Association. Joy, what would you think that they would be?
I think that the Snickers bar would be one of the
Snickers
top ones.
Is definitely up there. Reese's Peanut Butter Cups and M&M's are the three most popular.
Oh,
buy
okay.
those. Buy the nice ones and buy a lower quantity. Limit your budget. You know, spend $20 getting the good ones. And then as soon as those are gone, shut out the lights and go down to the basement and back to your Lifeline movie and your Pinot Grigio.
That is good. Yeah, my other tip is when you are in a neighborhood like we are that doesn't have all that many trick-or-treaters, I didn't really have to buy that humongous bag from Costco.
Good for you, because you know that's only going to one place if you don't donate, especially if you get something that's good. If you get crappy candy, then you know that it's going to be around there forever. But if you get the good stuff, you know that if you don't give it away, you're going to eat it.
All right, so you can call in with your questions and your favorite Halloween candies at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. Kevin is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. Dick in Neshota is with us. Hi, Dick.
Good morning. Thank you for such a great show every day, or every Tuesday, you folks.
Thanks.
Now, here's a question regarding paying off student loan. My wife will retire in a year and receive a lump sum payment as retirement bonus, and it'll be about $70,000. Our daughter is finishing up with a student loan of about $150,000. What would be the best way to assist in paying that $70,000 toward that $150,000 loan?
And this is money that you can afford to use, Dick? You've already kind of figured out that it's not necessarily going to be needed by you and your wife?
Yes.
Okay. Do you happen to know the interest rate of what your daughter's going to be paying on that student loan?
6.8.
Okay. Offhand, if it's money that's going to be taxed anyway, meaning the $70,000 is after tax.
After taxes. Yep.
Okay, that's good news. You can just pay the loan off, and you do have to file a gift tax return. You don't have to pay gift taxes on it because you're exceeding the amount that you can give a person in a given calendar year without filing the gift tax return. That's $14,000 per person per year. So you do have to file a gift tax return. I think that's Form 709. You just have to declare it. You don't have to pay any taxes. It's not a big deal. You just amend it to your tax return. That is the clean and easy and neat way to do it.
Should we do that in 2 years?
You can do it in 2 years, but even then, you'd still, $28,000 is the most you and your wife could give her without filing the tax, the extra tax form. So I would encourage you to just do it all in 1 year and be done. If you are concerned about, or if parents out there are concerned about their kids' responsibility, they'd like them maybe to suffer a little bit to understand the cost of their education. Rather than giving her all the money to make this significant dent in the loans, you may want to do it just to tell you what, we're going to make your payments for you, or until you can get on your feet, or until the $70,000 is used up. Or we are going to give you $500 per month. What you choose to do with that is your choice, but we would encourage you to make the loan payments for that. The disadvantage of that is you're probably not going to earn enough on that money while you still have it to offset the cost to her of that 6.8% interest, and especially not as guaranteed as that interest is. So from a financial standpoint, give her the money as quickly as possible, have her apply it towards the principal if she can, and then she's done with that half of the loans. If you're a little concerned about it, you want to kind of slow things down, or you might be concerned about your own situation, say, I'd like to help her out, but we might still need this money, then just either make the payments for her or give her a little bit every single month to just make some of the payments or do with it what she wishes.
And thank you very much, Dick, for the call and for the kind words as well. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. On Your Money is broadcast live every Tuesday morning from 8 until 9. If you are listening to us on Tuesday evening from 9 until 10 or Sunday morning from 7 until 8, you are listening to a rebroadcast. You can always email a question to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our next caller is Kari in River Falls. Hi, Kari.
Hi. I have a question about a HECMA loan and a home equity conversion mortgage. And I told my husband I'd call the financial guru and ask him about it.
What did he say?
So he said, okay, baby, whatever you want to do.
That's how I wish I could answer all these questions. Okay. From now on, we're just going to have a recording, a file, when I can't make it in. That, hi, I was wondering when I should take Social Security. Okay, baby, you do whatever you want to do.
That's a good answer.
So we recently were revisiting retirement areas, and they have this HECMA loan, which, like, we put down half of the money for the house. They finance the other half, and you never have to pay them back.
Mm-hmm. Sounds pretty good, doesn't it?
It does sound pretty good, but it sounds too good to be true.
Yeah, it's kind of a reverse mortgage.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily too good to be true. It's just what happens is that you put a bunch of your money into the equity of this home. Like you said, half of it, you said?
About half of it, yeah,
because okay.
I'm younger than him.
Okay.
So they, you know, he's 62, so we can get it, but I'm under 62, so they go by my age for how much we have to contribute.
Okay, what's going to happen is over time, that money that you get that you don't have to pay back, it's still going to accumulate interest. And you don't have to pay it back, but it will eventually eat away at the equity that you've put into it. All right. So let's say you buy this place for $200,000 and you put $100,000 in and you get this heck of a loan, which sounds like a heck of a loan, and it's $100,000 for this. Well, that will be $107,000 after the first year, $115,000 the second year, $123,000 the year after that, et cetera, until it eventually, that loan will rise faster than the value of the home will probably rise. And so if you have to sell it, all of your equity will be lost in the home that you've put in for it. Now, again, you don't have to pay it back, but as soon as you either pass away or you leave the home, you're going to move to a new place or whatever, the bank sells the home and you get whatever's left over after they pay the loan off. And if nothing is left over, you've lost your half of the equity that you've put into it. And the longer you stay there, the more likely it is that your $100,000 in my hypothetical case will have disappeared. If that's not a problem for you, it can be a good way to get into a house. But if it is an issue, I would be cautious about it and maybe see if you can get a traditional loan, and you might find that you're able to build up more equity over time that way, and then it becomes an asset rather than a liability.
Okay. Well, we were just, you know, they said we wouldn't like leave our kids in debt, so that's okay.
Nope, that part is true. Under today's laws, under today's laws, the kids don't have to pay off? Let's say the house is worth $150,000 and the HECMA loan balance is $250,000. Under today's laws, no, your kids don't have to pay it off. It wouldn't surprise me if in the future, though, under these loans, they change the terms so that they could actually go after the assets of the estate to supplement it, because somebody has to pay for that lost equity. And especially if we go through another housing crunch, people will find these loans are worth much more than the value of the home. In your case, I don't think that will be as big of an issue, because I think you're going to pay for it while you're alive rather than after you're gone.
All right, Kari, thanks for the call. Now we go to Ken in South Haven, Michigan. Hi, Ken.
Hi.
Yes, what's your question?
I need some advice from Kevin, if he could give me some. I've got about $120,000 in a money market with my bank, mainly the proceeds from the sale of a previous home. We own a home in South Haven and live in Virginia half of the year in a condo, which we still have a mortgage on. The question is, how best to invest that $120,000? Should we pay down some of the mortgage on the condo, invest it in other sources? We're both retired, have a pension income and Social Security for both of us.
Okay.
Advice?
Yeah, do you have other assets besides just these $120,000 and the various homes?
I have another $20,000 savings account, or actually a money market with American Century.
Okay, so but you don't have other significant, do you have like 401ks or invested assets, or is the $120,000 kind of represent the lion's share of your liquid assets?
That represents the lion's share.
Okay, that's good to know, and that's fine. And in your case, it's actually a good place to be, because you probably have enough income, I'm guessing, from your pension and Social Security kind of to cover your basic expenses.
Exactly.
Okay, then what I would do is I would definitely not pay down that mortgage, because your problem is not cash flow. If you're alive and the pension and Social Security are around, which it's highly likely they will be, you are going to have enough cash flow to not only pay for your living expenses, but to have some more left over after that and pay for the mortgage payment. What you don't have a lot of, Ken, right now is a lot of liquid assets. And so diminishing that by paying down the mortgage would actually exacerbate the problem. So I wouldn't pay that down any faster than you have to. I would keep that money as safe as you can. I would go back to the bank or the credit union, see what they will offer you on a CD for the longest term possible, especially if they only have a minimal withdrawal penalty for if you take it out before it matures. Something like 5 years, you should be able to get close to 2% if you shop around. And that's a nice way to keep the money safe, earn a little bit of interest on it, but also be able to get at it if an emergency comes up. So it's a very good question. I'm glad you asked. And no, my answer is don't pay that off any faster than you have to.
Thanks, Ken. Dean in Spring Valley, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
Our grandson has a little free library, and so along with candy treats, he gave out pencils, bookmarks, and a choice of a book for each person that came and visited.
I love it. That is a fantastic idea. And that's how old is he?
He's 11 years old.
Oh, good for him. Now, when people who aren't around kids very often, you only read stories or hear stories, you think, you know, we're going to heck in a handbasket with the next generation. This is a good indication that we are not, that there are good and decent, intelligent people in the world, and it's a great idea, Dean. I absolutely love it, and I like it because the other version I've heard on this that isn't quite as benevolent is where people hand out leftover zucchini, and that really weighs heavy in the kid's bag, and they're not excited to see it. So good for him. That's nice to hear.
That's great, Dean. And we're almost out of time, Dean. What is your grandson's name? He didn't hear me. I'm sorry. Well, good for you, Dean, and give our best to your grandson. Thanks very much. So we have just enough time for the website of the week, Kevin.
There are lots of different places you can go on the web to check out your Social Security options, which might be best for you. Most of them aren't very good. Most of them are not free, and many of them are not anonymous, meaning you have to submit your personal information. But Financial Engines just came out with one that's not perfect, but it's pretty good, and it is anonymous, and it is free. So if you go to financialengines.com, you'll find it, and we'll put a direct link up to the site at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Sounds good. And we have time for four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. And he is with us just about every week at this time with information and advice on your money. He'll be back next week. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.